Today on The Takeaway with me, Tanzina Vega, context on the situation in Venezuela.
People are really tired, and I talk to a lot of them who say, you know, I'm not going to get my hopes up.
Also, we take a deep dive into Attorney General Bill Barr's congressional hearings today and tomorrow. And as we approach Memorial Day, we'll have stories about the challenges military families face, starting with substandard housing.
Members of the military expect to take risks, but not with their families in their homes back here, yet they do.
All right, here we go. Demonstrations erupted on the streets of Caracas, Venezuela on Tuesday. Opposition leader Juan Guaido called for the military to abandon President Nicolás Maduro and for people to rise up in a video he posted to social media.
I call on you to mobilize. I call on you to take to the streets of Venezuela. The final phase of this transition begins today.
Protesters supporting both Maduro and Guaido clashed in the streets. Reports say dozens of people were injured. By mid-afternoon, the government had pulled both CNN and the BBC off the air in the country. And by the end of the day,
máxima serenidad, calma y cordura.
Maduro was still in power and gave a televised speech saying that Guaido and what he called the coup-mongering far right failed. This episode is just the latest eruption in the country's political and economic crisis. Back in January, Juan Guaido, the relatively unknown leader of the country's National Assembly, declared himself the, quote, legitimate president of Venezuela, demanding an end to Maduro's presidency. The U.S. government has been in full support of Guaido ever since. Here's National Security Advisor John Bolton speaking Tuesday to members of the media.
We're providing support in a variety of respects. Certainly, we have done everything we can to get humanitarian assistance into the country. We're doing a lot of other things, some of which I'm not going to talk about. And we're certainly working with the Lima Group, the Organization of American States, the over 50 countries that support Guaido's legitimacy democratically.
But U.S. involvement has many worried about who would benefit if Maduro is forced out. Reports show Guaido plans to broaden the role private foreign oil companies can take with Venezuela's oil. And while U.S. officials often talk about the situation in Venezuela in humanitarian terms, they've also made it clear the U.S. has a financial stake in the conflict as well. Here's Bolton again, speaking on Fox News in January.
Venezuela is one of the three countries I call the Troika of Tyranny. It'll make a big difference to the United States economically if we could have American oil companies really invest in and produce the oil capabilities in Venezuela. It'd be good for the people of Venezuela. It'd be good for the people of the United States. We both have a lot at stake here making this come out the right way.
Alejandro Velasco is an associate professor of history at New York University and author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics, and the Making of Modern Venezuela. He joins me now to discuss the developments and what could be ahead. Alejandro, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first of all, why did Guaido decide to release this dramatic video? Why this approach?
Well, the situation in Venezuela had been stalemated now for several months. Since he announced that he was interim president on January 23rd, there have been a series of escalating steps to try to force an outcome. We had the humanitarian attempt to bring humanitarian aid into Venezuela on February 23rd. And really what we'd seen since is very little movement, at least domestically. And so there's a real sense that he needed to shake up the landscape. And there had been some sounds on Twitter chatter and elsewhere that perhaps something was coming today. And so it did catch a lot of people by surprise that yesterday was when things went down.
There have been some folks who are watching this from afar and thinking Venezuela is on the brink of civil war. Do you agree with that estimation given where we are today?
No. And that's primarily because the government of Maduro continues to exercise significant monopoly over violence. The opposition certainly has significant support on the streets in terms of popular support as well as internationally. But as we saw yesterday as well in evidence, it still has no control over any sector of the military to speak of. That's not to say that there aren't non-state armed actors that could be involved. And certainly Venezuela is a very violent country in terms of street violence and crime. But a civil war scenario, such as we've seen elsewhere in Latin America, does not seem to be in the cards.
Why have Guaido and the opposition been so unsuccessful in their attempts to overthrow Maduro? I mean, Guaido has the support of the United States and at least in speaking of other countries. So what's the holdup here?
Well, I mean, that's the question the opposition has been put to over the last 20 years since they've been trying to oust first Hugo Chavez and then Maduro. I think in part it's a combination of factors. One is an overestimation of the strengths of the opposition domestically and abroad. There's a sense, even going back to the Chavez era, that because Chavismo cannot really be a significant force, that therefore just a little bit it would take to oust them, just a little movement here and there. But since Maduro has become so unpopular, that's less of an issue. And then the question is, well, where does the sources of support of Maduro come from? And it's primarily from the military. And it's in part because the military is so well woven into a broad network of corruption that they have significant amounts at stake in staying in power. So that's really been a significant, you know, drawback for the opposition's efforts.
I want to talk a little bit. You mentioned Chavez. I want to go into the history here because the U.S. does have a history of pushing for regime change in Venezuela. Tell us a little bit about when the United States did try to remove Chavez.
Well, the most direct effort was in April of 2002. There had been a series of escalating street protests around control over the oil industry, as you mentioned in your intro. And that led to a dramatic protest in the center of Caracas, and there was violence that broke out. And then Chavez was ousted, actually. He was out of office for about 72 hours until he was reinstated by way of a counter-mobilization. In the interim, the United States government came very strongly in support of the coup, and at that time, the Bush administration. But ever since, it's been closely aligned with efforts to either destabilize or otherwise disrupt Venezuela's Chavista governments.
Is the U.S. taking a similar role today as they did when Chavez was in power?
Yes, but less successfully.
Well, let's talk about that, because why is it less successful today? Is it because of Maduro's overall power with the military? I mean, does this risk the U.S. saying, okay, at what point do we or should we go to Venezuela and actually take an active role in deposing of Maduro?
I think that the answer to that lies in understanding the motives of the various players in the U.S. government. And so certainly if you think about Trump, his primary interest in Venezuela is not actually Venezuela. His primary interest in Venezuela is winning 2020, which he needs Florida in order to do that. And of course, there's a significant population of Venezuelan expats that have gone to Florida over the last 20 years. But more significantly, there's, as we know, a significant population of Cuban expats. And to the extent that the Obama administration and Cuba being Venezuela's primary partner had opened up relations with Cuba, this is really seen, especially by Marco Rubio, the senator of Florida, as an attempt to stoke up, right, that sense of anti-Cuban government action to bring up people to the voting polls. You know, for John Bolton, it's a different kind of strategy. For him, it's containment of Russia worldwide. For Mike Pence, it's a different motivation. It's about, you know, this personal relationship that he has with Juan Guaido, who's very Catholic, who's very devout, much like in terms of Christianity, Mike Pence. All of that is to say that the United States actually doesn't really so much care about Venezuela in this stage. And so because it's seeing Venezuela
or the Venezuelans.
Indeed.
Okay.
Right. But insofar as Venezuela is a piece and larger puzzle, it doesn't actually have a lot in terms of concerted strategy in Venezuela. It's just one step along other paths.
So that might explain a little bit about Marco Rubio in particular pushing so hard for regime change in Venezuela. Do they have any options going forward?
The opposition or the United States?
The United States.
Of course. Absolutely. So there was a huge round of sanctions announced earlier this year that really creates significant problems for the oil industry in Venezuela, which, of course, is the primary source of revenue of the government. But there's more sanctions that the United States could announce. And those could be even harsher, that could attack the banking sector in Venezuela and would make it really impossible for Venezuelans to be able to purchase anything, because most things are purchased electronically, not through cash, since there's hyperinflation. And so there's an array of things that the United States could do. Certainly, as the U.S. government has said, that all options are on the table. Intervention remains one of those options. I think it's a least likely scenario, but it's certainly there.
Do we expect Guaido and the opposition to continue demonstrations? I mean, what risk do they run in doing so?
Well, the risks that they run in doing so are less than the risks that they run in not doing so, right? So Guaido in particular needs to show, especially after what happened yesterday and just how much credibility he lost in saying the military is behind us, we can actually do this today, and then nothing happened in terms of military turning over, he needs to be able to continue to show that he can muster people into the streets.
Based on what happened yesterday, it does look like the country's military has continued to support Maduro, although Guaido, as you mentioned, said that he had the support of the military. What's the disconnect here? Does Guaido have any military support whatsoever?
I mean, the saying among Venezuelanists and Venezuelans is that the military is a black box, right? We can't really know what's inside of it until things happen. I think that the disconnect in part is that the stakes for the military, especially those in the higher commands, those who actually command troops, are tied to their survival in a transition regime. And to the extent that Guaido is unable to give assurances to these players that they will not be tried, that they will not suffer the consequences of some of their corruption and human rights violations, I think that really makes it impossible for them to imagine a scenario in which they would be safe in a transition. And so the disconnect is I think, primarily there. Can you provide assurances that we're not going to end up in jail for the rest of our lives? And if you can't do that, then why would we not continue to support the government in power now?
Let's focus a little bit on the humanitarian crisis that continues to unfold in Venezuela. We have seen life in Venezuela, not just inside Caracas, but outside of Caracas. There have been thousands of Venezuelans leaving the country. Tell us what the situation is on the ground today. We've got about a minute left.
Millions of Venezuelans over the last, 3 to 4 years in particular. The situation is dire. Hyperinflation means that people who don't have access to dollars by way of remittances or elsewhere cannot actually buy goods. The sanctions are now hitting the gasoline sector, so people don't have access to gasoline. People leaving, but they do so without any resources. And so what you find is that people are walking hundreds, sometimes thousands of miles to get to uncertain futures. Medicine continues to be dramatically scarce, and the situation only seems to be getting worse.
Alejandro Velasco is an associate professor of history at New York University. Alejandro, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
On March 24th, Attorney General William Barr released a 4-page summary of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. On March 27th, a letter sent by Mueller to Barr shows that the special counsel himself disagreed with how Barr framed the report to the public. In the letter released by the Justice Department today, Mueller wrote that Barr's summary of the report, quote, did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of this office's work and conclusions. Barr is testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee today, and here he is answering a question from Illinois Democratic Senator Dick Durbin about Mueller's concerns.
When I talked to the special counsel about the letter, my understanding was his concern was not the accuracy of the statement of the findings in my letter, but that he wanted more out there to provide additional context to explain his reasoning on why he didn't reach a decision on obstruction.
Barr is also scheduled to appear before the House Judiciary tomorrow. It's an opportunity for lawmakers to hold the Attorney General accountable for his handling of the release of the Mueller report. But as we know, it could easily turn into partisan grandstanding from both parties. Jessica Roth is a professor at Cardozo School of Law and a former federal prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York. Jessica, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Jessica, let's start with the letter that Robert Mueller sent to William Barr. He disagreed with Barr's summary of the Mueller report. How significant is it that the Attorney General may have misled the public on Mueller's findings? I mean, does it still matter now that we have access to more of the report?
It's extremely significant, and it's significant that Mueller even sent that letter in the first place. It's very unusual for a prosecutor to put in writing the prosecutor's displeasure with how the superior has characterized the prosecutor's work. We know Mueller is very circumspect and has really not spoken to the press at all during the course of his investigation. The fact that he thought it was necessary to put in writing his displeasure with how Attorney General Barr had characterized his report and conclusions, I think is very significant. And then, of course, the fact that of the mischaracterization is very significant as well.
When Barr testified before the Senate on April 10th, Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen from Maryland asked him this question.
Did Bob Mueller support your conclusion?
I don't know whether Bob Mueller supported my conclusion.
The letter released by the Justice Department today was sent on March 27th. So based on that information, what's your reaction to what Barr told Senator Van Hollen?
My reaction is that at a minimum, that statement from Attorney General Barr was misleading. He had heard from Robert Mueller, and in particular, that the displeasure was about the characterization of the obstruction of justice component of the findings.
Which is quite important. Tell us more about that, Jessica.
So in Volume 2 of the report, Special Counsel Mueller laid out the evidence for at least 10 possible charges of obstruction of justice by the president, but did not come to a conclusion about whether the president actually committed obstruction of justice. And Special Counsel Mueller explained that the reason why he wasn't reaching that conclusion was because he thought it was essentially unfair to do so, given that he was following Department of Justice guidance, a policy statement, that a prosecutor could not indict a sitting president. And if an indictment could not be brought and the opportunity for a trial had to clear the person's name, that it would similarly be unfair to characterize the conduct as a crime and to essentially accuse the president of a criminal charge when there would be no opportunity for a trial, and that it would impair the presidency while that charge essentially was out there in the air. What subsequently happened is that Attorney General Barr made a prosecutorial decision that seems to anyone who has read the Volume 2 of the report to be quite contrary to what Mueller was saying in how he laid out the facts and the law. And so I believe that Attorney General Barr knew, or at least was willfully blind to the fact that Mueller would disagree with the conclusion that there was no obstruction of justice here.
Jessica, I said at the top that this could just be political grandstanding on both sides. I mean, we understand the gravity of what's being said here, but what could the actual consequences be for this? I mean, are there consequences for the Attorney General, for example?
Well, the Attorney General of the United States is subject to impeachment. I don't believe that an Attorney General has actually ever been impeached, but it is a possibility. And so the standard would be the same as for the president, whether it was treason, bribery, or a high crime or misdemeanor. And so if the Congress comes to the conclusion that the Attorney General has disserved the public and even committed a crime, potentially himself, obstruction of justice or perjury, I'm not prepared to say that yet. But if they were to come to that conclusion, they could start with impeachment proceedings of the Attorney General. So that's one possible quite serious consequence. There also could be the chance of a criminal referral. There is precedent for an Attorney General, or at least a former Attorney General, to be convicted of perjury and obstruction of justice. And that was President Nixon's Attorney General, John Mitchell.
So Jessica, there's been a lot of back and forth between Barr and the Democrat-led House of Representatives about Thursday's hearing tomorrow. Why is Barr threatening not to even show up?
Apparently, Barr is threatening not to show up because he objects to being questioned by staff members for the committee. He is willing to take questions from the members, but not from staff. As I understand it, the proposed setup is that he will take questions from members of the committee, but then there will be afterwards 30 minutes of questioning by staff. And he objects to that. And there's precedent for staff for the committee to question witnesses and even cabinet-level officials. In recent memory, we saw Dr. Christine Blasey Ford questioned by someone who wasn't even a permanent member of the staff of the Judiciary Committee that was considering now U.S. Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh's nomination. The Republicans brought in an outside prosecutor to ask questions of a civilian witness. And historically, if we go back to the Watergate scandal, a cabinet officer was questioned by staff members in connection with those hearings. And in the Iran-Contra scandal, we also had cabinet members questioned by staff. So it's unusual to have a cabinet official questioned by staff, but there is precedent.
Why is his resistance to the – what does that – his resistance tell us?
Well, the advantage of questioning by staff is that it's likely to be much more professional and focused, and there will be follow-up. When we have questioning by members of the committee, as we've seen, it tends to be these fragmented 5-minute inquiries. It's very easy for the witness essentially to filibuster and use up the time. And
We've seen that quite a bit,
and it's very hard to get follow-up. When you have a professional, and usually these are trained, often former prosecutors, at doing the questioning, they're much more likely to ask precise, short questions, to ask the follow-up questions of the witness when the witness is not giving a responsive answer, and to actually get to the meat of the matter. That's why if you don't really want to be answering tough questions, generally, you would prefer not to be questioned by a professional staff member.
But what does that tell us about the job that both Republicans and Democrats are doing or aren't doing on behalf of the American public? If the attorney general has misled the American public about this report, shouldn't the job of the sitting congressional members be to do something about this?
It absolutely should be the job of the sitting members of the Senate to do something about it, regardless of party. It's a very sad state of affairs that I could so clearly say to you in response that we will definitely see different types of questioning depending on party. I agree. It should be the job of everyone, regardless of party, to try to get to the bottom of what happened and really probe the extent to which the Attorney General was misleading the public and the Senate.
Jessica Roth is a professor at Cardozo School of Law and a former federal prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York. Jessica, great to have you on, as always.
Thank you.
Well, we've got a big announcement for you. If you're in New York and you want to see The Takeaway live, join us at the Green Space here at WNYC Studios on Tuesday, May 7th at 9 a.m. Eastern. We're going to stream this as well in case you're not here in New York City with us. It's the one-year anniversary of my very first broadcast on The Takeaway. When I first sat in the host chair, I knew I wanted to address three major gaps that are at the root of many of our issues in this country: the wealth gap, the empathy gap, and the truth gap. And now, 1 year later, I want to know, have we made any progress in closing these gaps? We're going to have these conversations with live guests, free giveaways, and I'll even take audience questions and give you a behind-the-scenes peek at what goes into making the show every day. Tickets are free, but reservations are required, so visit thegreenspace.org/events to reserve your seat. That's green with an E at the end. We'll see you there at The Takeaway Live, May 7th, here at WNYC. As we approach Memorial Day, The Takeaway is going to spend the next few weeks looking at the challenges military families face, from finding love, to finding work, to finding good housing. One-third of all military families live in privatized housing. That's about 700,000 people. And the private real estate companies are pulling in billions of dollars in profits. But many of the families living in those developments say they found themselves in substandard conditions.
We're talking about lead paint, mold, mice, cockroaches, falling ceiling, leaking roofs.
That's Deborah Nelson, an investigative reporter and journalism professor at the University of Maryland. Last year, she worked on a Reuters investigation that revealed deteriorating and unsanitary conditions in privatized military housing.
Members of the military expect to take risks when overseas in service of their country, but not with their families in their homes back here. Yet they do.
The military says they're working on the issue, but Deborah Nelson says the stories of the families she spoke with have stayed with her.
So many families that we interviewed just had heartbreaking stories. The woman from Keesler Air Force Base, who, while deployed in Afghanistan, her life at risk, was more worried about her children back home because they lived in a mold-infested house and were getting sick. You know, Sharon Limon at Camp Pendleton, her family, they were among about a couple dozen Marine families that I met at Camp Pendleton who were battling infestations of rodents, bugs, mold, fungus, mushrooms growing out of the carpet. This is in housing run by Lincoln Military Housing. Lincoln's a giant real estate company. One thing that Sharon said that really stuck with me, and it's something I heard from many families, was that, you know, she and her husband had been prepared to make sacrifices for their country. What they had not expected in her case were the mice. A year-long battle with their landlord to get the problem addressed. And not just a few mice. They had dozens chewing through food containers, peeing all over the carpet. She'd pick her baby up out of the crib and find mouse feces on his leg. I mean, she said mouse poop was among his first words. And the landlord, Lincoln Military, blamed her housekeeping and really made her feel bad about it. And that really wasn't unusual. What we found there and across the country is that families were being blamed in numerous creative ways for all manner of problems. And their pets were being blamed. You know, across that same base, a family dog was blamed for a carpet so wet for so long that it eventually sprouted mushrooms. And their baby learned to walk in rain boots. Turned out to be a major roof leak. Then Lincoln blamed the weather.
This is a disgrace. And I'm wondering who is in charge.
We had a hard time finding anybody who would take responsibility There are about 200,000 homes on bases that have been privatized. Back 20 years ago, Congress privatized base housing because it was even in worse shape than it is now, due to years of neglect by the military. The idea, you know, is to turn over the keys to private companies that had experience managing residential properties and who could raise private capital. And it worked for a while. You know, the housing did improve, but the companies were given these 50-year contracts with that provided for almost no oversight, no effective oversight by the military, and provided tenants with very few rights.
Who are these companies? And when we talk about private companies, are they private landlords that a lot of us would have heard of, or are these private equity firms? Do we know who's actually making money here?
The companies, you know, also run civilian real estate. They're probably familiar to many of our listeners. Lincoln Companies, Hunt Companies, Corvias, Balfour Beatty. They're some of the biggest landlords in the country.
What kind of money are we talking about here? What kind of money are these folks making?
Well, the problem is that the government won't say. How much money these companies are paid is a secret. We've been able to dig up a few clues, and we're talking about millions of dollars in revenues are flowing into each company each year. How many millions? We don't know because the government says it's a secret, a trade secret.
Well, it's a trade secret, but people have to pay rent, right? Military families are paying rent to these companies and are also living in disgraceful conditions. I'm not sure what the military means by a trade secret, but that seems to be a disconnect here.
I agree.
Who's looking over their shoulder, Deborah?
There was nobody looking over their shoulder. What we found was that the contracts gave a lot of autonomy to these private companies to run the housing. The contracts actually gave ownership of the houses in a long-term lease on the land to these companies. And military base officials had very little authority to intervene. So when tenants, when military families would complain up the chain of command, there was little the chain of command could do to fix those conditions.
How did you learn about this story, Deborah?
Military spouses contacted us. The first calls were about lead paint hazards in homes. Darlena Brown, an Army wife at Fort Benning, whose young son he suffered permanent developmental damage from lead poisoning, reached out. It was too late for her son, but she really wanted to prevent other families from that sort of pain and suffering. So my reporting partners, Josh Schneer and Andrea Januta, began investigating, and they found lead hazards weren't a problem confined to one home or even one base. You know, meanwhile, we started hearing from other families about severe mold and rodent infestations on other bases across the country. So Mike Pell and I began investigating those reports. And over, I think, about 18 months, the four of us visited 16 bases and interviewed 250 families. Those families had been trying to get the attention of military officials for years to the conditions in which they were living, and without success. And it's only then that they reached out to us out of desperation, really.
So the military turned a deaf ear to these families, is that right?
Yes, they weren't being listened to. Every base had a military housing liaison office, but they had no real authority to intervene. They could beg and appeal to the housing companies to fix the roofs, to clean out the mold, but they had no real authority to make them do it.
After your investigation, has the military responded?
The military responded immediately. As our stories began running, the military, each of the branches, sent out top commanders to every base in the country. And this has never happened on a story I've done before. They reported back that the problems were even worse than we had described. I think so far some 10,000 homes have been reported in need of safety repairs and upgrades based on surveys. And the Senate has passed legislation, and there's legislation pending to give tenants more rights, to provide more oversight of companies, to penalize them financially if they don't fix these problems, and to allow local code enforcers on base. One of the things we found was that, you know, some of the basic tenant protections that civilians take for granted are not available to military families. We talked about Sharon,
whose house was overrun by mice. If she was a civilian tenant, she could call the local housing inspector, and the company could be fined and forced to clean it up. But they're not, they have no authority on military bases. Legislation that's pending right now would allow them to come onto bases and protect tenants.
How long do you expect these changes will last, and will they ultimately have an impact on future housing for military families? Because, and what about the military families that are currently living in these conditions?
The fixes can't happen fast enough for the families living in these conditions. You know, we're talking about young children. These are young families that live on bases. They can't afford to move off base. It costs thousands of dollars to do so. And, you know, kids growing up with chronic respiratory problems can have long-term consequences.
Deborah Nelson is a freelance investigative reporter for Reuters and a journalism professor at the University of Maryland. Deborah, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We reached out to the Department of Defense, and a spokeswoman sent a statement acknowledging that, quote, there has been a lapse in overseeing implementation of DOD's housing privatization program. The statement also mentioned that the DOD is working on a tenant bill of rights as a first step on improving trust with military families. We also reached out to Lincoln for comment. They disputed the Lamone family's version of events with their mouse infestation. Lincoln also pointed to a survey that showed residents of their military housing rated the company's customer service as exceptional for the fifth year in a row. Find out more at thetakeaway.org. And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.